The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Please don't fast forward this intro. I have a couple of things that I just must say. The first is Happy Mother's Day to all of you who are mothering. You are so spectacular. This is so hard. It's so rewarding. And you are so doing enough. The fact that you're here and the fact that you're curious means that every single one of the humans you're raising is so lucky. And I'm so lucky to have all of you in my life and all of your support and all of your trust. I take it so seriously. I'm so honored. And I hope you treat yourselves with such grace and love and kindness on Mother's Day. You so deserve it every day. And now I also just wanted to give you a proper introduction. I don't always have an introduction that is absolutely necessary. So if you fast forward it, I understand. But this introduction really puts this episode in context. Welcome to Raising Good Humans. I'm Dr. Aliza Pressman. And today's episode, I have a lot of feelings about because it's with Jonathan Haidt, who wrote The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. Jonathan Haidt is a social psychologist. He's a professor at NYU. He's also written The Happiness Hypothesis, The Righteous Mind, The Coddling of the American Mind, and All Minus One. Now, I have a few things that I struggled with before I interviewed John because the very nature of anxiety made it feel like calling the book The Anxious Generation and the Great Rewiring of Childhood Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness and all of that felt very anxiety provoking in and of itself. And it felt like, well, this is an important message that we absolutely need to get across. Like, we need to reduce the amount of time spent on devices, and we need to fix social media and reduce access and exposure and delay and all of those things. I could not agree more. But the approach felt fear-based, which I was hesitant to share with all of you because you know that my role is not to scare the daylights out of parents, because we know something. And the reason that I wrote The Five Principles of Parenting was to remind everyone that our relationship and close connection and our reflection and our regulation about these very topics and our rules around these very topics and the repair when those rules or when our regulation go awry are so profoundly influential on what happens when our kids do have too much exposure, when we do make mistakes, when we have allowed for things that we now regret, like maybe earlier use on smartphones than we had hoped for, that matters so much that I don't want parents to be like, well, I guess this ship sailed, my kids are totally screwed, and they've been rewired. So I hesitated. But then it felt like I owe this to you, because I do think that John's point that even if some of these data are correlational, and even if we don't have all the answers, and even if I would say this is not the defining feature, I think that, you know, we could miss the nuance of other things that might be going on for kids and for young people. We can't wait to find out all that information before acting, because we do need to get these phones out of the schools, and we do need to get them out of the bedrooms, and we do need to get them out of the hands of younger brains. And so, and also for the ones who are older, we need to kind of have a better relationship with it. So that is why I invited John to talk about The Anxious Generation. But I really think once you unpack it, it's less about how awful this device is and these apps are. And it's more about what they take us away from. And so rather than fixating too much on how awful things are, I really want to encourage people to listen to this through the lens of, so what can I do that is in my control as a parent to help better support my kids and give them the childhood and adolescence that they deserve? And I think that's doable. So this is my offering to you. I think Jonathan is doing incredible work and articulating it in ways that is going to make really important changes. But I just want to make sure that everybody knows that if you are leaning into your relationship and your limits and boundaries, your kids are going to be able to get through this time period, and we can make changes and know that it's not going to compromise our relationships. And those relationships, we know, are such a key factor, if not the key factor, of development. Okay, so I'm thrilled to offer this conversation. Please remember that you can always send me DMs or go on to my Substack, dralizapressman.substack.com. It's a free newsletter, and you can send in questions there as well. And join me for my monthly live Zoom groups. Those are through Substack as well. It's the one paid item that I have, and it's $4.99 a month. But then we can have conversations. For example, how are you feeling about this episode? And finally, I know I say this a lot, but it really, really matters. And it really only translates to one or two people doing it. But please write a review, a positive review on Apple Podcasts, and give a 5-star rating. It really helps spread the word and get this podcast out. So, and if you have constructive feedback, just send me a DM. I know a lot of you are comfortable with that as well, and I so appreciate it. And of course, if you've not bought my book, go ahead to Amazon or wherever you like to get books at your local bookshop and get The 5 Principles of Parenting, Your Essential Guide to Raising Good Humans. And if you have purchased it, you can write a little review on Amazon. Have I asked enough of you? Okay, let's to this conversation. And of course, it really brings up a lot of questions. So I want to make sure that you know that you can keep reaching out, and we're going to have a follow-up conversation in the future. I want to take advantage of having you here, but I don't want to fixate on some of the fears, because I would rather talk about the parts of anxious generation that give us some solutions, and also the parts that are less centered that you talk about that help us build healthy kids. Mm-hmm. And in the absence of all the screens, so that we can have access to solutions in this very digital age, and also recapturing some of the parts of childhood and parenting that don't get so much attention as being beneficial.
What I find is that when I talk about this, like, so I was on The Daily Show last night, and whenever I mention the kind of childhood that we all used to have, and I said, for everyone over 40 in the audience, just think back on your childhood. Did you have adventures? Did you have fun? And there was like a big round of applause. Like, whenever I mention this, older people are like, oh yeah, childhood was really fun. And my kids don't get that. So yeah, let's talk about the positive vision of childhood. This is not just about taking away the phones.
Yeah. And I think it goes without saying, and maybe just because it's helpful to frame this, how did you end up getting here? Like, you're making a movement, right? Yeah. Like, this is officially a movement. I don't know anybody that hasn't been talking about it. How did you get here? And what are the most important things that we can consider without, you know, again, taking into account that this particular audience, I think, has been fairly conscious of their phone use, but it's still never, you know, like, we're all doing this and trying to toggle between keeping up with technology and also, like, not just saying like back in my day, but taking the good of technology, and also remembering that there's so much that we need to do in childhood to bolster our kids' resilience.
So I think the way that I've ended up, I don't want to lead a movement. I'm a scholar. I'm a professor. I like reading and writing. I don't want to do administrative work. I don't want to hire people. I don't want to, so I don't want to be doing that. But on the other hand, my book came out with the most perfect possible timing at a moment when parents all around the developed world are sick and tired of it. They see the problems. They know in their hearts that the phones are a problem. They've been told by some researchers, oh, well, there's no evidence. Oh, well, it's just correlation. It's not causation. But they know that's not true. They see it in their kids. And so my book came along at exactly the right time. Now, how did I get there to the point where I'm a social psychologist who studies morality and politics? That's what my day job is. I'm a professor at NYU Stern, the business school of NYU. And I've been focused on what the new digital world is doing to society and democracy. That's my focus in the last 8 years or so. And I got a contract to write a book called Life After Babel, Adapting to a World We May Never Again Share. And so that's what I set out to write, was that book on democracy and how it may not be compatible with the digital age. The digital age does so many weird things to social interaction that the kind of world that the founding fathers imagined is dead and gone and will never return. A world based on text with some stability and some ability to make arguments. And so all that's gone. And so I started writing that book and I thought, I have this side project on teen mental health because I wrote The Coddling the American Mind with Greg Lukianoff. Something happened to college students. We saw in 2015, the students coming in 2014, 2015 were really, really different. They were fragile. They were anxious. They were self-harming. They were in defend mode. They were not open in the way that we think college students are. So this for me was a side project originally, but it was about universities, which is very much my domain of interest. So I wrote that book. And then I thought, let me go back now to studying democracy. So I figured, let me just make chapter one. I have all this data on what's happening to young people as soon as they move their lives onto social media in the early 2010s. Let me just write one chapter showing that. And then the rest of the book is going to be about, well, now let's look at what happened to liberal democracies when you move it onto social media. But once I had written that first chapter and I got all the graphs together, it was so shocking. And around that time, I began to discover it wasn't just us. You can have whatever theories you want about what happened in America in 2012. But the exact same thing happened in Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand. We now know it's the Nordic countries as well. It's not so much the developing world, but all across the wealthy world where kids are not very rooted, where they have a lot of liberty. That's where kids got swept away. And so I wrote that first chapter and then I realized, whoa, I can't just like leave this here and move on. And now that's okay. So now that I've scared you that our kids are all going off a cliff, now let's talk about democracy. So I felt like I had to write another chapter and I wrote a chapter on childhood. Like, okay, let me at least explain because I'm also a cultural psychologist. I've studied moral development, cultural development. So let me explain what childhood is biologically and why human childhood is so weird. And so I wrote chapter two. And then I thought I'd move on. Well, but the girl story, I mean, there's so much evidence. Like girls are really getting crushed by social media in a way that it's not affecting boys as much. Like, I need a chapter on girls. And then I need a chapter on boys. I can't leave the boys. So once I had four chapters, I realized that, okay, this has to be its own book. And then I realized this is the biggest thing I'm ever going to face in my life. I'm 60 years old now. Let's say I have another 10 years left of good work. This is it. Like this is my chance to really make a difference in the world. So I decided to really focus on this. And I think the reason why I sort of fell into this accidentally is that I'm a social psychologist, very sensitive to group dynamics, mob dynamics, what happens when everybody can talk about everybody all the time with amplification from algorithms. They're all on social media only because everyone else is. That's why they have to be on it. They themselves say it's terrible. They themselves say they'd be better off if TikTok was never invented. So I think I was able to see the sort of the group dynamics issue that many other researchers had missed.
And now a little break so I can tell you about Mudwater. I am a coffee drinker. I drink so much coffee, it's unacceptable. So when I can find something that gives me the yummy warm boost of the ritual of coffee without so much caffeine and so much, it's just too much, I am in. So I've been swapping my afternoon cup of coffee for Mudwater. And yes, I do have an afternoon cup of coffee. So I can still get the energy that I need, but no crash or jitters. I am so into Mudwater because it's a healthy habits brand best known for its popular coffee alternative, Rise Cacao. It has 4 functional mushrooms and with only a fraction of caffeine that a cup of coffee has. So it gives you a little natural energy, and the ingredients are very purposeful. Cacao, chai for a little caffeine, hot chocolate-like flavor, lion's mane for focus. There's just a lot of good. And it's also 100% USDA certified organic, non-GMO, gluten-free, vegan. It's even kosher. Mud Water is hooking my show up with a special offer. So if you go to mudwater.com/humans, you get a free frother and $20 off. That's mudwtr.com/humans for a free frother and $20 off. That's mudwater.com/humans. Do you know how much cash back you're leaving on the table settling for the wrong credit card? Imagine earning up to 5% cash back on your groceries for the next 30 years. Think of all that cash back. NerdWallet helps everyone make smarter financial decisions today that future you will thank you for. And with NerdWallet, you're not going to regret missing out on rewards, because NerdWallet lets you compare smart cashback credit cards side by side to make the most of your everyday spending. So what could future you do with more cash back? Are you going to get away without the kids? Are you going to do a spa day for yourself? Whatever it is, make it happen with smarter cashback credit cards. And don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms do apply. Here's what I'm curious about. If the kids are in this, you know, very important wiring phase, and there's like a couple of years where it's particularly important. I mean, it's all important, but a couple of years where there are parents who have made the decision, their kids are now fully exposed, even if they have limits, the phones are away at night, there's many things that have to happen during the day, they're not having their phones at school, but they're still feeling like, well, in the absence of a collective movement, because it will take a little time, although I think it's really moving, in the absence of a collective movement for this like 2-year window of kids who are between 13 and 16, let's say, mm-hmm. what are we doing for them?
So, yeah. So let's talk about puberty, because that's the key to a lot of this. So there's the free play part, which we'll talk about. And that's especially important for kids in elementary school. They need huge amounts of free play and independence. They're not getting it. And then when we get to middle school, of course, play and independence are still extremely important. But this is where the phones seem to do the most damage, especially to girls. Because in puberty is when the brain is rewiring very rapidly from the childhood form to the adult form. And different, it happens more or less from back to front. First, the rear portions of the brain sort of rewire, lock down, and into the adult pattern. Because you know, the child's brain is about 90% of full size by the age of 6. So don't think about wanting your kid's brain to grow in middle school. The brain's not going to grow. It has too many neurons. And what happens is some of the neurons die because they're not needed. Others get cemented in because they're being used a lot. So if your kid is spending all day long presenting her brand to the world and monitoring her reputation, well, those certain neurons are going to get really reinforced and others are going to die away. So we really have to pay a lot of attention to, especially early puberty. That's like especially 11 to 14 for girls, 12 to 15 for boys. This is when we should be most careful. And unfortunately, in most Western countries, this is when we become least careful. I was just in Britain. A quarter of their 5 to 7-year-olds have their own smartphone. Britain is ahead of us in hooking every child. Every child in Britain goes through all of puberty on a phone because they get them from age 5. We're a little behind them. Some of our 11 and 12-year-olds don't have a smartphone. Most of them do, but not 100. It's not 95% the way it is in Britain. Your question was, what do we do for the kids who got a smartphone at age 10, which is the typical. In America, it's usually 10 or 11 is when we give our kids smartphones. We get them just before puberty. We say, here, you're about to start puberty. Here you go. Here's a phone, Instagram account, you know, horrible videos, beheading videos, whatever it is. You go watch them. So, you know, all around the world, we're making this huge mistake. Now, what can you do if your kid is already, as like most parents, your 14-year-old has been on for several years? I would not advocate taking the phone and social media away from your child if you're acting alone. What kids most care about, of course, is what other kids think of them and their relationships. And I've heard it said that, you know, parents often use taking the phone away as a punishment. I will take your phone away if you don't do what I say. And I've heard, you know, there are cases of kids who commit suicide because the parents don't understand that their whole social world is through the phone. And so if you take it away, now you're giving them social death. So I'm not advocating just, you know, if they've been on it for years, their whole life is on it. I'm not advocating just rip it out and say, tough luck, kid, you know, you're going to be raised without it. I think it's too late. But if you can act together with other parents, and presumably everyone listening to this podcast, I assume the great majority are parents of kids or teenagers. And that means that every one of us is on a text thread with the parents of our kids' friends, because we have to, you know, birthday party drop off. Oh, you know, we'll be a half hour late. I mean, so we're all communicating. We're already communicating with the parents of our kids' friends. What I'm hoping to do with the book, with The Anxious Generation, is to make it so that if you reach out to your friends, say, you know what, I'm concerned about, you know, our kids are spending too much time on their phones and not hanging out with each other. How about if we try to organize more hangout time for our kids? I can almost guarantee you that some of the other parents on your text thread have read the book or have heard about it, and they're going to be like, yes, I was thinking the same thing. So what I would especially urge, if your parents are, you know, if your kids are already on it for years, don't think so much about taking away the phone. Think much more about giving them an exciting social childhood. And that means hanging out with their friends. So actually, you know, let me run this by you. I mean, an idea that Lenore Skenazy and I, you know, who wrote Free Range Kids, we co-founded letgrow.org. An idea that we've come up with is the simple phrase, free play Fridays. So this especially is great for elementary school. So what if we all say, you know what, no piano lessons on Friday, no, you know, no anything. Friday afternoon is just for the kids to hang out. And ideally, it would be, you know, 3 or 4 days a week, I think. But let's just make it Fridays. And what's so great about that is you make it a group, not just two kids. I mean, it could be two kids, but it's much more fun if it's like four or five, you know, like a small gang of kids. And you say, okay, we've got five participating families. And maybe we've got actually, you know, five families. You might have, say, seven kids between you that are real close in age, let's say. And you say, okay, the five of us are in. Maybe we'll take turns rotating. So the kids start off at my house this month, you know, or this month or this week, but they're free to roam. If they're out together, it's fine. You know, we don't necessarily want kids wandering off when they're 9 or 10. At 12, it's okay. A 12-year-old should be able to walk around town. But, you know, if you've got a bunch of 8-year-olds, they can walk 4 blocks together to another house, and that's exciting. They're not supervised. They're out in the world. So if you think about, okay, my kid is like most American kids, you know, she's having a phone-based childhood and I know where this leads. I don't want it. Think about giving her a play-based childhood, which with a lot of unsupervised hangout time. And then it becomes, it's not bitter medicine. It's actually, hey, you know, do you want a childhood more like me and in your grandparents had, or do you want the childhood that you see all around you? And most Gen Z, they're not in denial. Most of them will say, yeah, I want that.
Well, and I think the Free Play Friday can become something similar to, you know, if you just have, you always have like family dinner on Friday,
yes,
let's say.
Exactly.
And so you make it a tradition and a ritual. We have that here. One of the kids' parents hosts, mm-hmm. at, you know, one family hosts, everybody comes over and
that's great.
You know, it's different ages and it's an annoying night where you can't go to a party because but everybody's in it together. And so you have enough mm-hmm. friends that there's something to do. And yes, you can walk around and you can do whatever. And I think for older kids, that can be a similar thing to this after school Free Play Friday, which frankly, we all want that. But I think what's important about what you said is that for the folks who are not, they haven't given their kids phones, just don't yet.
Yeah, that just delay.
Makes it much easier. Just delay. And mm-hmm. you might not be able to delay to what I like about your guidelines is I think that it's going to be hard for now to say like nothing until 16. But I also
think... No social media around.
But I also think if we thought that 13 was this magical age... Like
not,
none of it, yeah. You know, the truth is, as you say, and as we know, it's not like at 16, they wake up more capable. It's just like they have a little bit more brain development and enough that it feels like, okay, we're not in this very tender time, but it's never awesome. Mm-hmm. But what I think is important about what you said is that so let's say you're delaying, if you have younger kids and you just don't even have to worry about this. Awesome. If you have kids who are already on screens and they are already on social media, reminding ourselves that there are ways to pack the day in so that even if they have phones, there are times that they just don't. Like, it's okay to say on Fridays, we just don't have phones. We just put our phones away. Or it's okay to say that there's a lot we can do because we're missing out on things when we're on our phones. Yeah, that's right. So it's not even just like the phones themselves. It's what are we not doing when we're sitting on our phones?
That's right. It's called the opportunity cost. What are you giving up if you spend your time on something else? Okay, so a bunch of things to talk about. Just a quick note. The reason why Lenore and I picked Friday as the special day is because, first of all, there's no pressure of homework for the next day. Second of all, the kids are likely to have so much fun that they're going to say, hey, what are you doing tomorrow? Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I'm free. No, I got in the afternoon. Oh, yeah, I'm free in the afternoon too. Okay, let's meet up tomorrow afternoon. And it could turn into a sleepover. That's the first thing. So that's why Friday is so valuable. Second thing is Jewish families obviously have Shabbat. And Orthodox Jewish families, you know, they literally no phones, no electronics at all for 24, 25 hours. So Orthodox Jews have that big advantage. I gave a talk to like 50 heads of schools of Orthodox Jewish day schools. And what I learned is that many of the schools have a rule that if you send your kid to our school, you can't give them a smartphone at all. They can't own one. It's not just they can't bring it. Like we will not take a kid if he has a smartphone because that's pumping so much garbage, so much non-kosher stuff into their eyes and ears. So religious communities have a real advantage here in being able to structure both limits, but also community. So that's very, very important. And then the other thing is, you know, my whole story in the book is it's like a tragedy in two acts. It's the loss of the play-based childhood from about the 1980s through 2010, and then the arrival of the phone-based childhood from 2010 to 2015. But by the end of writing the book, I realized that there's actually a third piece to this that we talk about a bit, but we don't emphasize it as much, which is the loss of community. Because what we see in the data, what we just began to discover, Zach Rausch, my research partner and I, what we just began to discover in the data is that when you look at the graphs of who got super depressed after 2012, the religious conservative kids, that is kids who say religion is important in my family, and kids who say that they are conservative rather than liberal, those kids only get a little bit more depressed and anxious. Whereas kids who said that they're on the left, they're politically liberal, this is high school seniors. We don't ask this of middle school kids, but high school seniors, there's one data set that asked this. Kids who said, I'm liberal, not conservative, and religion is not, they disagree with the statement, religion is important to me and my family. Those are the kids. They were a little bit more anxious and depressed before 2012. But after 2012, they're the ones who get washed away. And so our interpretation, and there's other data supporting this, our interpretation is that kids who are rooted in family, tradition, you have to go to church, you have to go to synagogue, you have to visit your grandmother, you have to, you know, you have to do the dishes. Like kids who are doing things with other people, especially with other adults, they have some real protection. And if they spend an hour a day on TikTok, it's not going to harm them. Whereas the more secular liberal kids who are, you know, liberal progressives tend to use more permissive parenting than conservatives. So they have fewer rules, fewer restrictions. Those are the kids who, when TikTok came out, they're not doing just an hour a day. They're 3, 4, even 5 hours a day. And that, I think, is incredibly bad for their development. So everyone should be on the lookout for rooting your kid in stable groups with people who will still be there a year later. Because in the online world, you're associating with millions of people, most of whom are gone in an hour. Like they don't even exist, a lot of them. They're bots or they're avatars. So our kids are starving for community. And no matter where your kid is, no matter how long they've had a phone for, if you can give them more community, it'll be easier for them to put down the phone.
You know, if you don't have a community because you don't have a religious-based life or you just haven't lived in this, you know, it's a harder way to live. There are other ways to find community and tradition. And I think just the idea of taking from that what is wonderful, it's so true. If you have something to look forward to, an expectation that you're, even if it's your chores, it's like the routine and ritual of it all is so helpful.
That's right. Routine and ritual. Because once you get a kid on a phone, there's no routine. There's no ritual. There's no time.
I don't know how long you're going to be doing it.
Yeah. No, there's no, you know, it never closes. It's global. So it's not as though it ever gets late on the internet. It's always on. The kid is always on. But okay, you just said something very important, which is even if you're not religious, you can give your kid more community. What are your ideas? Tell me, how would you, if you were, you know, if you had no religion whatsoever, what would you do? If you're, let's say you're living in a suburban area, You have some friends. What would you do to give your kids more community?
Like you said, the chats are, there's a whole conversation to be had about what's happening with adult chats and parent chats.
Oh God, there's just too much, too many interruptions, too many texts now. Yeah.
So much. But I think one of the things that people can say is, oh my God, it turns out that having routines and rituals is so beneficial to our kids. How about is anybody up for something weekly that we can all commit to? And also, I think getting outside, as we all know, finding touching the earth, being somewhere outside together, you know, it's hard to find that. And especially when we get pushback, but if we can sort of accept that pushback happens and not be so afraid of it, I think then they get to have the experience over and over of having these routines and rituals baked in, even if you don't have a spiritual community center.
I think that's a great idea. Making it, you know, every Friday or Saturday or Sunday, or making it the first weekend of each month.
Even sports. Like I'm not a sports fan, but my watching other people become so oriented towards supporting their particular sports team, there's something religious in orientation about it that I kind of love.
Absolutely. Oh my goodness. No, sports appeals to some of the same brain centers that are at the center of religion, because what religion does, which is a sociological miracle, is e pluribus unum. Religion makes, from many people, you make it into one congregation. That's the sort of a sociological view of what religion does. But sports teams become a unit, and then they're doing battle with another unit, and then we're all, you know, fans of it. I've argued in my book, The Righteous Mind, that we evolved for war. It's a long part of our heritage, is group versus group. We have all, and especially in the male mind, as soon as there's a conflict, the male mind gets into battle mode and our thinking changes. It gets very narrow. And so we evolved for war, and we like many aspects of war. And because we like those aspects, we develop team sports, which are, you know, it's like ritualized war. And we love rooting for it and, you know, cheering for our team. And the research is very clear. Jean Twenge first brought this to our attention in her book, iGen. When you look at which kids are doing worse, it's the kids who are spending more time on screens. When you look at which kids are doing better, it was two things. It was religion and sports. The kids who had weekly, regular religious practice and or team sports especially, those are the kids who are doing better. So the only thing I'd caution about, I'm not a sports fan either, so I didn't emphasize it as much as I should have. The best kind of sports is pickup games where the kids organize it.
Yeah, this does not translate to then joining a club team and being all about that. I meant like going, you know, to community.
Oh, being a fan.
Going to games, being a fan, playing with each other. Yes, I mean being a fan. And I think that probably translates, by the way, if religion doesn't work, and sports doesn't work, if you have theater. Like I was a theater kid, but it was still a community. It's like finding your community and going and seeing and watching together the greats in that community and supporting them and cheering. And I think sports probably.
That's right. Okay. Because, you know, the way that you really form friendships is not just by talking. Talking can work, and especially for girls. But what really does it is you do something together. And so, and this is why when men come back from battle, when men come back from war, they have lifelong friends. They've gone through something together. They have a bond like that is not available to the rest of us. When you're on a sports team with someone, especially a team sports team, you're so interdependent. You're fighting together against an external enemy that bonds you. If you build something together, if you suffer adversity together, if you went through COVID together or an earthquake or whatever it is, doing things together, suffering together really bonds you. When our kids lost the ability to do anything, when they basically just sit alone and they're on their phone or their video game controller and they're chatting or they're DMing their friends or whatever it is, they're not doing anything. There's no action. There's no motion. There's no risk. So the kinds of friendships you can forge with just a million little digital exchanges are very, very thin, very unsatisfying. And I think that's why as soon as the boys moved their lives onto video games, they're in the late 2000s, they became much more lonely. And as soon as the girls moved everything onto Instagram and other platforms, they became much more lonely. So don't focus on just talk. try to give your kids a chance to do something. It could be going camping, going to a sporting event is a thing that you do together. That's fine. Something that involves some risk. So, outdoor activities, whitewater rafting, whatever it is. And also don't try to monopolize. Look especially for ways that your kids can have adventures with other kids, not with you. Because the kinds of adventures that people remember from the child is not, oh, that amazing trip we took and we were in a balloon with my parents. Like, no, it's, it's the time that you and three other kids got lost. And you find your way through the woods and somebody remembered something and you made whatever it is. It's a shared adversity and an adventure. That's what people remember from their childhoods. A good community, a good life, would be one in which you've done a lot of things and you also talk about them. You don't want to just do things and not talk, and you don't want to just talk and not do things. So you want to mix. And as people get older, they're going to do less stuff and remember more. That's fine. It's often occurred to me, when I think back on my childhood, I remember my best friend and I, we got in a rock fight with kids at a local school that we were cutting through their property and they didn't like it. And, we didn't get hurt. I mean, there were a couple, you got hit by a rock here and there, but we didn't really get hurt. But boy, do we have a memory. And we still talk about it. And what I'm thinking is when I think today's young men, think about a 12-year-old today, or I was probably 10 or 11 at the time. Think about 10, 11, 12-year-old boys today. And think about them getting together 40 years from now. Are they going to say, hey, do you remember Fortnite Battle 27,361 where you were pinned behind that water drum and I had to liberate you and then we both got killed? Remember that? Like, no, they're not going to remember that because they didn't do anything. They didn't do anything. And they're playing tens of thousands of games where they don't do anything. So that kind of pushes out any possibility of actually having adventures.
And now a quick break so I can tell you about Mysteries About True Histories. Mysteries About True Histories, affectionately known as MATH, is a weekly show full of time travel, puzzles, hidden equations, history, and a lot of laughs. It's from the creators of the hit podcast, Who Smarted? The goal of MATH is to weave humor and education together so the kids won't even realize they're learning unless they love learning. In which case, go ahead and tell them they're learning. The series explores themes like the stories behind math, critical thinking, code breaking, pattern solving, and more. MATH is geared towards kids 6+, but it can be enjoyed by the entire family. Episodes drop every Thursday and they're about 15 minutes, and it's absolutely perfect for the length of a car ride. Every episode follows two best friends, Max and Molly. They work together to solve riddles and math equations during their time traveling adventures. Episodes transport listeners to moments in history like Pythagoras's ancient Greece, the era of the Aztecs, Sir Isaac Newton's England, and more. That's Mysteries About True Histories. Follow or listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to pods. It's such a cute listen. Be sure to check it out, especially now as we're talking about finding alternatives to screen time, sitting in the car, listening to this adorable podcast. This episode is brought to you in part by Saks.com. Saks.com is an easy way at your fingertips to find style inspiration for fun, meaningful, situation-specific moments. Saks.com is making it easy for me to put together outfits for my book tour. Basically, I want to be able to wear things in different ways multiple times because I don't need a brand new outfit for every single event, but I want to have fun and look put together. So if you want an easy way to go shopping, go to Saks.com. They have instant inspiration for finding a new look, refreshing your closet, and it's easy to navigate. You can plug in by size, by price, by shape, by type of clothing. So if you're like me and you're looking for great work outfits, new investment pieces that make you feel really good and really comfortable when you have to put yourself out there, go to Saks.com. It's so easy to find your new vibe. You can shop Saks.com for everything on your agenda, whether it is a Chloe blazer for a book tour or a breezy Zimmermann dress for date night. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com. can you speak to everyone listening who feels like anxious about all that can go wrong? And is that sort of, I guess what I'm struggling with is, it's like we're trying to have this conversation of benign neglect in certain areas, please not in this area.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, we're having these conversations about, you know, we want to be so perfect as parents that we've almost pathologized parenting, and we've pathologized so much in our kids that it's just like wear and tear of being a person. And I'm seeing that. And then I'm seeing that, you know, for those parents, there's maybe a fear of what happens if those kids aren't socializing on the video games or on social media. Mm-hmm. And also, I think that maybe those parents are very much controlling social media and phones. And so for them, it's lifting some of the weight of the real world stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there are other parents who I think are feeling like, well, everybody's pathologized so much and they're so in it and they're so overbearing. I'm stepping away from this. It's so confusing.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I'm leaving.
You're very
this
happy
to
thank you. No, yes, that's a great prompt. So I'll start with a fear-based appeal just briefly and then move to a more of a hope-based appeal. So the fear-based appeal is this. In the United States, there's something on the order of 100 true kidnappings a year. The FBI, you know, there are a lot, you know, when a child is taken, it's usually by the non-custodial parent. It's not a stranger. If we look at true kidnappings, a stranger takes a child. I mean, that is a crazy thing to do, to take a child. It's incredibly risky for you to steal a child. You know, if you're caught, you will be thrown in jail forever. So, you know, it's just not a common thing in this country. Now, there are countries in Latin America and elsewhere where kidnapping is a major issue, but it's not an issue here in the United States. But because of this 100 or 200 kidnappings a year, we freaked out in this country and we said we can never let our kids out because they'll be kidnapped, they'll be sexually abused, they'll be sexually molested. So we let them spend more time on computers online. And originally, the internet wasn't so dangerous, but then you get social media, you get all these programs that help strangers reach your child. As soon as your child is on Snapchat or Instagram or any of these platforms, strangers from all over the world can now contact your child. I mean, if you really are super duper about the privacy settings, but it just ends up that they're talking to the world. And some of these strangers they're talking to are men who are pedophiles. Now, there used to be pedophiles hanging around playgrounds because they wanted to get a look at young girls or young boys. And I'm not saying that doesn't happen anymore, but most of them have moved on to Instagram. Like, why would they hang out at a playground and risk being arrested when they can just go onto Instagram and have girls send them photos of themselves in a bathing suit or, you know, or even naked? Mm-hmm. So the fear-based appeal is this. The real world is so much safer than it was when we were growing up. However old you are, unless you're like 20, you know, but if you're in your 30s or 40s, the real world is so much safer now than it was like in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. You know, so death rates are down, crime is down, drunk driving is down. So the real world is much safer. You should lower your guard, let your kids out. They have to learn to navigate in the real world. Whereas the online world is so much more dangerous than it was when you were young. You know, in the 90s, it wasn't that bad. And now, I mean, the stuff that kids are sent, I was just in the UK and they're talking about the number of kids who see beheading videos. Imagine your child being sent a video of an actual head being cut off. These things circulate on the internet. And there's even more, I mean, I can't say more horrible, but it is more horrible somehow. There's a video that was being sent around, I think it was last year, called Cat in a Blender. And it is exactly what you think it is.
Oh my God.
And this is the sort of stuff that your kids are going to see. And so, you know, so this is the fear-based appeal, that the real world is so much safer than you realize. And the risk of your kids being taken by a predator is so microscopic in the real world. But in the virtual world, the risk they're going to see the most horrible stuff you can imagine and all kinds of hardcore porn. They're going to see all those things. Not just a few of them are going to see it. All of them are going to see it. And many will be approached by strangers. In fact, we just had a post on my Substack, After Babel. I hope all listeners will go to afterbabel.com. It's the Substack where Zach Rausch and I put out our research. There's no paywall. You don't have to give us any money. Everything's free. But we just had a post by Arturo Bejar, who worked in Meta. He was a high-level security, you know, working on user safety. And his 14-year-old daughter, when his daughter got on Instagram and started posting pictures of herself repairing cars with Arturo, they were both into repairing old cars. She was repeatedly contacted by men who were not harassing her, but they were clearly hitting on her. And she's a 14-year-old girl, men are hitting on her, and there's no way to report it. There's no way to report it because it doesn't cross the line into sexual explicit content. And so Arturo said, wait, this is, you know, Meta isn't doing anything about this. And he went to them and he said, here's what we need to do. We need to just add a way to report inappropriate contacts. Doesn't mean we're going to kick that person off. But, you know, if there's a guy who is inappropriately contacting thousands of 13-year-olds, like, yeah, like we should kick him off. Yeah, right. We should do something. And Meta took no action. They didn't do anything. So again, what I'm saying is the real world is so much safer than you think. And the virtual world is every bit as dangerous or more as you think. That's the fear-based appeal. Now, the more positive appeal is let's not focus on our fears. Let's focus on our hopes. And what do you want for your child? Do you want your child to have fun? Or do you want your child to just always be safe at home? Do you want your child to have thrills and adventure? Or do you want to be sure that there's no risk ever that your child will hurt herself physically? Do you want your child to have confidence in facing the physical world, going out and being able to make judgments for herself? Or do you want to always be there to make the decisions for your child and to supervise so that she doesn't get hurt? So if you think about a more hopeful appeal, imagine the kind of child you had or the kind of child your parents had. Now, is that what you want for your kids? Or do you want a phone-based childhood, which is what they're getting? And I think pretty much every parent is going to say, no, I don't want my kid to grow up just sitting there on a phone or a video game all day long. I want them to have a human childhood. And so if we focus on giving them back human childhood, now it's much more positive. Now, of course, if you send them out into the world with a smartphone, they're going to sit down outside and use the smartphone. I just did an interview this morning with a reporter in Finland. Scandinavians are great at letting their kids out. They didn't freak out the way we did in the Anglo countries. So Scandinavian kids at the age of 7, 8, you know, they're wandering around their neighborhood, they're free. So that's great. But guess what? She said, we send them out and they just sit down there on their phones. So they're not really exploring. They're just outdoors using their phones. A phone is an experience blocker. The day you give your kid a phone is the day it moves to the center of his or her life, and it will stay there for the rest of her life. It's going to be the center of her life forever. She's never going to, it just said, we're stuck using them a lot. Kids are going to be using them a lot more than we use them. So you have to be really thoughtful about that decision. When you give your kid a smartphone, that is going to block out most other experiences. So do you decide at what age are you willing to do that? And I think the answer, you know, what I said, I think the answer should actually be 16 or 18. But my goal in the book was not to lay out what's perfect. My goal in the book was to identify 4 norms that we could actually do at mass scale. And so what I realized was the transition from middle school to high school. In the United States, we have this very clear transition. Around the age of 14, you move, 13, 14, you move from middle school to high school. And I realized, you know, it's going to be very difficult to get it out of high school. It's so woven into life. But man, let's put all our chips on middle school. Let's start by just saying, you know what? It's just not appropriate. Like we all know now, it's not appropriate to give your kids cigarettes or vodka or to take them, to get them gambling or to give them a smartphone or social media. We should just know that. You don't give a middle school kid a smartphone. You give them a phone watch or a flip phone. By all means, you want to be able to reach them. You should send your kid out. You want them to be able to text you. You know, dad, something went wrong. Can you pick me up? Fine. Let them text you. They don't need a supercomputer with 1,000 entertainment options in their pocket at all times. If they have that, that's what they're going to do.
And I also think if they do already, but I do agree that like middle school is, ask any middle school teacher, like if you even ignore data, like it's just so fraught. So, but if they have a phone, they don't really have a phone. You have a phone that they are borrowing. And maybe, you know, one solution, if you already, you know, feel like, well, now what, the cat's out of the bag, is like, they still don't always have the phone. Like, what are the times when you can say, yes, I'm putting all this in one instrument and handing it to you? Mm-hmm. And when can you say, like, it's not available? And
I think you do need good. Let's talk about that. Because there's very little that they must do on their phones that they can't do on their laptops. And so, you know, especially since COVID, most kids have a computer, most kids have a laptop. And what I've done in my family, what my wife and I did, was, well, with my son, we gave him a phone when he started walking to school in fourth grade. In retrospect, I wish we'd given him a phone watch. with my daughter, 3 years younger, we gave her a phone watch, a gizmo watch, when she was in third or fourth grade. And I would send her out to get bagels a few blocks away, and she'd get lost, and she'd call me once. She got lost once, and then we figured it out, and then she never got lost again. So I'm glad we did that. When we did move her onto a smartphone during COVID, when she was in sixth grade, we tried to delay all the way through sixth grade, but we couldn't, because they just expected your kid to have a phone even in sixth grade. So we gave her a smartphone. But what we did was we said, when you're at home, the phone goes on the counter, kitchen counter, charging. You don't get to use your phone in the apartment. Now, we haven't cracked down on the laptop very much. We did put on screen time limits, because otherwise she would just spend all day watching videos. But the a laptop is not as addictive as a touchscreen. A touchscreen, a very important concept in psychology is stimulus response behaviorism. If you do an action and then a reward comes, what matters is not the size of the reward, it's the speed of the reward. So if you do, like if you're trying to train a dog and you say, you know, sit, and the dog sits, and then you wait 60 seconds and give them a piece of steak, nothing happens. They can't learn from that. But if they sit and a tenth of a second later, you're like, yes, and you give them right away, you give them a little tiny treat. That's how you train a dog. So a smartphone is the most powerful dog trainer ever, except dogs aren't using it, kids are using it. So the more you can get your kid to not use the smartphone. The smartphone, okay, you're out, you're on the subway, you're you know, bicycling to school. Okay, we gave you a smartphone. I wish we'd given you a flip phone, but okay, you have a smartphone. But for God's sakes, I'm going to push your school to go phone free so that you're not using it all day long during class. Phone free schools is the easiest thing we can do. We can do that by September. We can get every school phone free by September, or at least we should push on it. So if your kid's really just having the phone to get to school and then home from school, and then they put it on the kitchen counter or in a lockbox, and then you can figure out what your policy is on laptops. You know, they can do Instagram, they can do everything on their laptop. So they don't need the phone, but it's going to be easier to control the laptop. The best policy of all, especially if you have younger kids, I would say, is get a desktop computer and put it in the living room or the kitchen, because there's all kinds of reasons why your kids should be on the internet. There's all kinds of good stuff. There's amazing videos. So I'm not saying, you know, go full Amish or Orthodox Jewish and say, right, you know, none of this. I'm not saying that. But if you have a family computer in the living room, that's pretty safe. What I'm told, I'm working with Melanie Hempe, runs this great organization called Screen Strong. She takes a really hard line. Her son was really devastated by a video game addiction. She takes a much harder line than I do. But she says that the really bad stuff tends to happen when they have a screen in their bedroom at night. That's when they get into a chat with somebody, you know, some stranger. That's when they get scammed. That's when the boys get sextorted. That's when the boys are watching porn.
And so, that's when you're taking sleep away. So then you make
decisions. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. That's right. So the issue isn't just, does your kid have a smartphone? The issue is, do they have unrestricted access to it? That is, I think, what's most devastating.
So I know you have to go, and I could just keep you here for days. I want to read something that you said, and this can just be something people keep in mind, and they can get your book if they don't already have it. But this is something to just think about for us as the adults, as we're kind of coming to terms with how much time and how much use and all of that. Mm-hmm. Is that you said, when people see morally beautiful actions, they feel as though they've been lifted up, elevated on a vertical dimension that can be labeled divinity. When people see morally repulsive actions, they feel as though they have been pulled downward or degraded. And obviously that's a whole other conversation. But I just was thinking about, even when we're looking at social media today, I'm guaranteed we will get struck by some things that can get you to feel like the world is such a bleak place. And if you're a developing human and that's piled on top versus all of the incredible things that this world has to offer and that people do for each other, it changes your wiring, as you said, and what we practice grows stronger. So
yes,
even right. If we can minimize access, like honestly, when people say, well, what if my kid sneaks, you know, Instagram on their friend's phone? Mm-hmm. I don't care.
Yeah, they're not going to be using it 6 hours a day.
Yeah. I mean, it's sneaking and lying, and you'll come to terms with that and have a conversation, but it's not, you know, you're not inundated with images that really make you lose faith in like what we're doing here.
That's right. So there's, you know, late in the book, when I was already way past deadline, I realized the whole book was about kids, and I haven't said anything about adults, but all of us are suffering. All of us feel this overwhelmed. We feel there's something wrong here. And since my first book was The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom, I've read the wisdom literatures of most cultures. I read, you know, whatever I could find from 1,000 years ago to 3,000 years ago. I've read most of what I could find. And I extracted the main advice for a good life from ancient religious traditions and philosophical traditions like Stoicism. And, you know, they say things like, be slow to judge and quick to forgive. Give people grace, be forgiving. But social media tells them, judge now, immediately, with no context. And if you don't judge now, someone's going to judge you for not judging. Why didn't you like my post? Why didn't you say something about it? Like, so this is just a morally degrading environment. It pushes against ancient wisdom, ancient religious wisdom, and modern psychological wisdom. Awe in nature. I'm an awe junkie. I've always loved climbing on rooftops and mountains and getting views and feeling small and looking at the night sky and lying out in the grass and looking at the moon. I love the emotion of awe. And I did some research on it with my friend Dacre Keltner, who went on to write a great book on awe. And imagine taking all the awe out of your life. Like, that would be tragic. Now imagine taking all the awe and all the nature out of your children's life. They get to watch nature videos. They can see amazing nature videos, but it's not the same. It's not the same. Especially if you're watching on a small screen. It's not the same as going out for an actual hike and climbing up a mountain and getting the view over the other side, or hiking to a waterfall and then bathing in the waterfall. So when we think about, you know, what is a spiritually ennobling life, where you have moral virtues, you model moral virtues, you see other people, you hear stories about people and their virtues, which is what you get in religious sermons. If you go to church or synagogue, you'll get those stories, those uplifting stories. And in so many ways, humans can either be, we either can, I mean, look, I'm a Jewish atheist, but religious language is what I needed to tell the story in chapter 8. Some things make you feel closer to God, some things make you feel further from God. And I think watching the Cat in a Blender video, or seeing a beheading video, or seeing the kinds of hardcore porn that our kids are seeing, that does not make them feel closer to God. So yeah, let's think about our, you know, my point is, the phone-based childhood and the phone-based adulthood, they have spiritual consequences, even if you're an atheist.
Well, that feels like
that's a good place to stop.
Please note that this episode may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products and services. Individuals on the show may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to in this episode.